Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, the U.S. Energy Department issued a report predicting a massive increase in domestic oil production over the next 2 years. The report projects that domestic production would increase by an average of 800,000 barrels of oil a day annually through 2016. A few years ago, the United States imported half of its oil supplies. Today, 37% of oil is imported, and in 2016, imports are expected to drop to 25%. Energy historian Daniel Yergin told the New York Times that the report confirms, quote, that the United States really is experiencing an energy revolution, end quote. According to the report, natural gas will soon replace coal as the largest source of electricity by 2035. Even though fracking continues to receive widespread criticism in many scientific reports, the fracking boom is expected to continue, and that includes here in California. Experts are interpreting this report to mean that the United States is moving closer to energy independence and that oil prices will fall accordingly. But what does all of this mean for renewable energy? According to the Energy Information Administration, 36% of energy used in the U.S. comes from petroleum, natural gas 25%, coal 20%, and renewables only 9%. The Obama administration has made renewable energy a top priority, at least in theory. The president recently ordered federal agencies to double their use of renewables over the next 7 years, but to make actual progress on cutting emissions, most experts say that's not enough. So where do we stand right now? What does this report mean? And what will it take to make real action? Today, we're joined by Catherine Wolfram, the Cora Jane Flood Professor of Business Administration and Director of the Energy Institute at the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business. Catherine researches energy efficiency and energy use in the developing world. In order to combat climate change, she says we need to reduce emissions by 80%, which would be a massive sea change. And Catherine joins me in studio. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Daniel Kamen has parallel professorships in the Energy and Resources Group, the Department of Nuclear Engineering, and the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. He also serves as founding director of Cal's Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory. Daniel says that to combat climate change, the world has to cut current greenhouse emissions by 90% by 2050. And that means we have to get more involved politically. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. So first off, let's talk about this report, because this is getting a lot of attention. And it's being framed in such a way that this is really great news. This is rosy because we are now going to produce much more of our oil, natural gas in the United States, which means we don't need to go to other countries. Catherine, what's your reading of this report?
So it really depends what your goal is. If your goal is energy independence, then certainly it's great news. It's great news to be producing oil and natural gas here within the borders and not to be importing it from Saudi Arabia, from the Middle East, for instance. But if your goal is climate mitigation and reducing the climate or the CO2 intensity of our energy infrastructure, it's okay news. It's not the answer, but it will help. It just won't get us all the way to achieving our goals.
Did this report spend much time on renewables?
So renewables are a small share of our total electricity production now. And I think there's some hint that they'll become a larger share, but change moves very slowly in the energy industries.
And what was your reading of this report, Daniel?
Well, I think it sets up an interesting shift in that we've been thinking of our baseline source of energy for electricity in the past being coal. And as you said in the intro, that's being replaced with gas. And so that decarbonizes the baseline energy. But the shift we need scientifically to address climate change, as Catherine and I have said, is much, much larger, 80 to 90% reduction. And so the real issue is, how do we use this shift to gas to pivot to efficiency, renewables, and other sources? And that's really left out of the report. There is a little bit of discussion about the degree to which the market for solar is growing, and California is a big part of that, how we're seeing some interesting technological innovations. And the technology baseline we have to make this shift has, in fact, changed dramatically. What hasn't changed is the overall equation, where we're seeing much more deployment outside of a few leading lights in this area. And that's really the critical story that we need to turnaround almost entirely by roughly 2050. So that's a huge piece of the equation which is not included in this assessment of the U.S. transition to gas, if you will.
Because this would require a massive sea change by the year 2050. And Daniel, you say in order for that to happen, people have to really become very politically active. So how this report is being framed in an interesting way, and I wonder what message you think it sends to citizens. So the New York Times headline, surge seen in U.S. oil output, lowering gas prices. And you know that drivers love low gas prices. And then another piece by the AP, gas prices are likely to be lower in 2017 as the nation's energy future stays on a positive path. So what message is this sending, Daniel?
Right. Well, I mean, it's certainly sending the message that that the discovery and the ability to extract, particularly fracked in these so-called tight formations gas, is put us on a green path. And that's just not true. What it has done and what President Obama highlighted in his July speech on climate is that it's reset the baseline. So we no longer need to think, at least in the U.S., about what are the levers to push hard on the coal to gas transition. But what we need to do is to pull the levers, both technological, policy, and behavior, to utilize that switch so that we're pivoting from coal through gas to clean energy, not just pivoting from coal to gas, which wouldn't get us where we need to go. And so the report is a good start and assessment of where we are. Fracking is still very controversial. But the real challenge is making the rest of the story happen. And that's place where we have very good technological options now, but we're far behind in terms of some of the market and the financial mechanisms to make that happen.
Just to add to that, people refer to natural gas as the blue bridge to a green future, but I think that highlights that it is just that. It's the bridge. It's not the end goal. As Dan has said, it won't help us get all the way to the 80, 90% reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. The other point I would make is that lower price natural gas actually makes it harder for renewables. So I've seen this with the MBAs coming out of the Haas School of Business, that in 2009, when gas prices were higher, when there was serious discussion at a federal level about some kind of climate action, the clean tech sector was booming. It was much easier to get a job in the clean tech sector than it is now with $2 natural gas. It makes it, you know, much harder economically to justify a serious investment in renewables without some kind of climate action at the federal level.
Can you explain the cost? How is it set for natural gas?
So it's set in the market, and basically fracking has dramatically increased the supply of natural gas. So, you know, it's been really a technological revolution from the perspective of the production of natural gas. And you can see that in the prices. You know, as recently as, say, 2007, prices were $10 per MMBTU, and they've dropped below $2. So that's just a dramatic change.
And this is really significant because the report projects increased exports of natural gas over the next few years. This represents a massive change from just a couple of years ago.
Yep.
When the U.S. was importing more natural gas. And it says that natural gas will overtake coal as the most important source of electric power generation in the years ahead. Again, this Energy Department report predicts that by 2040, natural gas will account for 35% of total generation, while coal will account for 32%. Right now, it's flipped.
Yep.
So talk about the significance of that.
Yeah, so that's very significant. I mean, right now we have plants built to burn coal and fewer plants built to burn natural gas because we have historically relied more on coal than natural gas. And so making that shift, power plants tend to live 60, 65 years. So making that transition to, you know, a pretty different electricity system is dramatic. I think one point to think about also is what's happening to the coal that we're not burning. Unfortunately, it's not being left in the ground. It's being pulled out and shipped abroad, shipped to China, shipped to Japan. Recently, Japan announced that they would build a coal plant on the site of the Fukushima nuclear reactor, and largely driven by cheap coal coming in from the U.S.
So even though coal will not provide our electricity, the companies will still extract it and send it overseas?
Yep, as long as somebody wants to burn it, they've got the coal to supply.
So the difference is that we will not burn it here.
Yep.
And how will that affect the environment?
So from a climate change perspective, it's a global issue. It doesn't matter where the CO2 or where the greenhouse gas emissions come from, as long as they're going into the atmosphere. It undoes the gains that we're seeing in the U.S. if other people are burning coal in other countries.
Daniel, that important fact is not included in most of these reports. And should you think it should be?
Well, it certainly should be. But there's a number of pieces of the story that I think need to be pulled together. One is that there's no question that the economically driven and technologically driven transition from coal to gas in the U.S. is a good thing. It resets our baseline emission numbers lower. But one way to put this in perspective is that in most of the United States, gas is seen as the clean fuel. And it's about half the emissions as the emissions relative to coal, with a lot of uncertainties. We're still trying to figure out the emissions, the leaked emissions of methane, a whole variety of features that might make some natural gas actually worse than coal. But that story aside, gas is cleaner than coal, and it looks like a decarbonization for most of the U.S. But in California, gas is already the dirtier baseline. And so the challenge is that while Kathy said that the lifetime for power plants is often 60 years, we're now talking about embracing and using more gas now, but knowing that we need to phase that out only over half that time or so. So a plant built today needs to be economic over not 60 years but 30, because we know that by roughly 2050 we will have to get rid of those. So U.S. relative to California sets one example. And then the international story is true right now. We are seeing coal exports from the U.S., not just to Asia, actually. We're seeing some coal, ironically, going to Europe. But China is in a very similar situation than the U.S. is, just a couple years behind. Their supplies of natural gas, both conventional and unconventional, are actually larger than ours. And they're not technologically ready to extract it yet, but that is coming. And so I was just in Ellensburg, Washington, and some of the towns that are choosing to invest in wind versus coal. And the story we're seeing is some of those deals to dramatically build up the capacity to export coal, for example, to China, are now looking much less likely because China is seeing this gas transition in its future as well. So the bigger story is, yes, coal not burned in the U.S. could be burned elsewhere, but places like California, like Denmark, Germany, Portugal are all seeing that the mixture of improvement in technology, for example, in solar, wind, fuel cells, biomass, means that we can use this moment to make a much bigger transition. But that's going to require not only pushing these technology levers, but also saying we need to change the financial rules. And right now, the big issue is that California has a price on carbon. There was a price on carbon in Europe. It still exists, but it's dropped dramatically. They basically gave away permits. China has a small but a cross-the-board price on carbon in place. And the question is, can we combine these financial levers, a carbon market as we have in California, or a carbon tax as being discussed in some places and exists, for example, in Norway, so that we can use this moment and utilize some of the partnerships that gas and renewables can put together to make this transition much more dramatic, much more like what we are on a path to do right now in California.
So if we're talking about the profit and the economy, when you look at the low cost of natural gas, Catherine, what is the financial incentive for corporations to embrace alternative energy?
It's harder with cheap natural gas because that's what you're trying to replace with renewables. And right now, as Dan mentioned, there are some places in the world where there's a price on CO2 emissions, but those prices tend to be lower than what economists think they need to be to really inspire an energy transformation. And they're zero in a lot of places as well. So that just makes it harder to justify an investment in renewable technologies that are trying to replace cheap natural gas. One other point I would make, just keying off Dan's point about the gas in China, I think that highlights what I've emphasized before. which is the large-scale infrastructure investments that are needed to really transform the energy the energy industry. So China has the natural gas underground, but they need to build the infrastructure to extract, to transport, to burn electricity, to generate electricity from that natural gas. And that takes time, maybe less time in China than in the U.S. They tend to be good at big infrastructure projects, but it takes time and it takes a lot of capital investment to make that transformation.
The thing is, I would add to that, though, is that what's interesting is that we are seeing examples of things going on today that 10 years ago just didn't look possible. The prices for a number of renewables, solar is the one that gets a lot of attention, but others too, are coming down in a way that thinking about solar cells on the rooftop of one's home or business or large facilities, as California is commissioning now, and Ivan Paul on the border with Nevada and elsewhere, mean that we can now think about that transition very differently. And in fact, gas and renewables can be used in a really ideal partnership. The low price of gas retards investment in the clean energy options, as Catherine said. But the second part of that is that until we have large amounts of energy storage technologies deployed or an ability to switch rapidly between wind and solar and geothermal, gas is really a useful part of that equation. California's plan is actually to decarbonize to the levels that we're talking about, this 80 or 90% level by mid-century. And while there's some huge challenges in getting there, I think that all the signals are that if we keep going the way we're doing now, we'll be able to get there. What we need to do, though, is to make that a partnership with not only neighboring states, but with China and other parts of the world. And that's a story about which policies work well and which mechanisms like carbon prices or pushing industry to divest in a sensible way their fossil fuel holdings. It's those transitions that we really need work on, and we're way behind in those areas.
That is Daniel Kamen. He has parallel professorships in the Energy and Resources Group, the Department of Nuclear Engineering, and the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. He also serves as founding director of Cal's Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory. Catherine Wolfram is the Cora Jane Flood Professor of Business Administration and director of the Energy Institute at the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about our current energy situation. And in light of this report from the Energy Department predicting a massive increase of in domestic oil production over the next couple of years, what does this all mean for renewable energy? We're seeing a massive increase in fracking across the country. So what does this mean for renewables? And we already have a few calls on this, and listeners really, really want to talk about this issue. You can join us at 866-798-8255. I mean, we've spent years talking about alternative energy. Why is it taking so long? What are the real solutions? And what keeps you optimistic when we talk about alternative energy? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. If you work in this field, what changes have you seen over the years? You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Larry in Hayward. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the show. Hello, Larry. Larry wanted to say that the Monterey Shale in California is being fracked for oil, not gas.
That's right.
So that's important to point out.
Yep.
And there's a part of it, too, in that the Monterey deposits are exceedingly large, but they're actually quite a bit different geologically than some of the others we talk about. They're a very folded. It's like taking layers of a blanket and folding them in strange ways. It's an unusual deposit, and it is likely to be quite technology, energy, and water intensive to extract. And so while it does look like a big resource, it has some challenges. And one of the implications of that is that if we see a huge push only in that area, we are effectively denying the funds and the technology and the resources to build up the other parts of the energy equation, the renewable energy sources, of which California has also been incredibly successful with globally leading programs in solar, in energy storage, in electric vehicles, that put together as a package, we are finding in my lab could really make up essentially all of our energy mix in the way we need by mid-century.
Yeah, so just on Larry's point about oil, we've been talking a lot about natural gas as it influences the electricity sector, but the transportation sector is also very important to talk about. And in California, it's more than a third of our greenhouse gas emissions, the transportation sector.
Well, we actually have a caller on transportation, so let's hear from Sarah in San Francisco. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, on the demand side, I was wondering how we can help mass transit because it's fragmented among small local governments, and there's a spiral of poor service, low ridership, low funding, leading to poor service.
Go ahead, Daniel.
I mean, it's a great point. Our transportation policies are no more coherent than our energy policies. But there are some interesting signs of hope. California is pushing ahead on high-speed rail in a large way, which is a very big, big budget and controversial investment. But we're also seeing everything from communities that are benefiting by being near BART, the so-called walk to latte quality of living is something which is being highlighted in housing prices. And so there are a number of measures that individual cities are doing to improve the quality of local mass transit. But consistently, the caller is right. What we're seeing that works better is regionally well thought out strategies. So, for example, you can make an urban core like San Francisco or New York quite clean by having low vehicle ownership. But if what you're really getting is lots of people commuting in on their own cars, the carbon shadow and the lack of mass transit to those areas means that we have to think in a much more holistic way if we want to make the kinds of options that we see in Europe, in parts of Asia, the basic transportation equation here.
What would you add, Catherine?
Yeah, just two things. Well, first of all, I love Dan's optimism, and I hope he's right. I do think that the caller's point is another example of the infrastructure. And right now in the U.S., we have a very car-dependent infrastructure. We have just, you know, miles of roads and parking lots, and you know, our houses are spread out. So it's hard to get people to use public transportation when we've built our lives around cars. I also think that, you know, dealing with problems in California is one thing, but California is kind of a drop in the bucket. And we need to think about solutions that work in China, that work in India. You know, there are more than 2 billion people in those countries. And so we need to think about solutions that will work worldwide.
How does your thinking about these issues change when you expand your thinking and bring China and India into this conversation?
Yeah, so someone once gave me the analogy, you can't tell a person who's been starving their whole life not to eat a cheeseburger because it's got too much cholesterol. That if you don't have that cheeseburger yet, if you're just kind of craving substantial food, then cholesterol be damned. And so I think, you know, that's a good analogy that there are large parts of the world that aspire to U.S. standards of living, and energy is a big component of that. And so I think, you know, we have to work to ways that will help achieve that growth, but in a much lower carbon intensity.
Are you as optimistic as Dan?
I think it's hard. So people joke that economists would never make a good political candidate because we're saying things like we need higher gasoline prices. But I think that humans are naturally innovative and naturally resilient. So I think that that we will come through and that there will be a technological revolution and an innovative solution to this problem. But I do think that the solutions that we have now are not enough. Solar prices have come down dramatically, but they're still not, without subsidies, not cost competitive with fossil fuels.
Well, we'll definitely talk about more solutions after the break. Catherine Wolfram is an economist at UC Berkeley. Daniel Kamen is an energy and nuclear engineer at UC Berkeley. And we're talking today about the future of energy and what this new U.S. Energy Department report means for the future of especially renewable energy. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your Call on Local Public Radio. We invite you to join the program this morning if you have a perspective that you have not yet heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered. Please get in touch by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you'd rather write, send us an email question or comment. The email inbox is feedback@yourcallradio.org. And don't forget, coming up at 11 o'clock from the World Service of the BBC, it's World Have Your Say.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a debate about the emerging field of synthetic biology. Biologists are now synthesizing everything from petroleum to vanilla, which is in a lot of food that you probably eat. And the Bay Area is ground zero for the research. Proponents say this will save natural resources and curb global warming, while opponents say it's an extreme version of genetic engineering and poses far too many environmental and health risks. So where do you stand on synthetic biology? And if you don't know much about it, be sure to tune in tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. Today, we are talking about the future of energy. A new report from the U.S. Energy Department predicts a massive increase in domestic oil production. They are looking at an increase by an average of 800,000 barrels of oil a day through 2016. Natural gas will soon replace coal as the largest source of electricity by 2035. So what does this mean for the future of renewable energy? Renewables are now about 9% of the energy we use, 36% comes from petroleum, natural gas is 25%, and coal is 20%. And we're talking about these issues with Catherine Wolfram, the Cora Jane Flood Professor of Business Administration and Director of the Energy Institute at the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business. Daniel Kamen has parallel professorships in the Energy and Resources Group, the Department of Nuclear Engineering, and the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What questions do you have about the future of alternative energy? And are you still optimistic? We've been talking about it for so many years. We often have people on talking about solutions. So why aren't we moving faster in this area? You can leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Donald in San Francisco. Hi, Donald. Hi, Donald. I hear someone there. Are you there, Donald? All right, let's try George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Listen, this is a question which your guests seem appropriate to respond to, and it has to do with a factor in energy future that we've never discussed for some reason, or if we have, I was snoozing, and that is how much water do these systems require, and how much do we have on tap?
If the
glaciers melt, that has an impact on how much technology we can apply to boiling water.
Yeah, it's such a good question.
So in a way, what we're saying is we have these systems that are water-driven, but we haven't said anything about our inventory of water. If we have 65 years for a power production facility, how many years water do we have to operate that facility? Does any of this make sense? It's not too woo-woo, is it?
Well, no, because, I mean, this is really important. When we did the show about fracking with a California official, and his name escapes me right now, he wasn't really able to answer most of our questions about where fracking is happening, but he was able to say that fresh water is being used for fracking. And I'll find those specific numbers. But what are your thoughts about this important question, Catherine?
Yeah, the caller is exactly right that water is a key part of the equation. And, you know, it's all interdependent. We use energy to pump water around. So the more water we use, the more energy we use. And I think, as you indicated, fracking has been a technological revolution in the production of natural gas, but it requires a lot of water.
I mean, it requires millions of gallons of water.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
I'm looking for the specific numbers. But Daniel, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I mean, there are some cases where production of fracked gas or the cleaning up of Canadian tar sands into oil can be as much as 1,000 gallons of water used, not all of it wasted, but used and some of it recycled per gallon of fuel. And that's an extreme, but there are some really huge numbers. So the caller is right that this is a number. In fact, it's a number that is affecting us in a lot of ways. There are power plants in desert areas, both fossil fuel plants and some solar facilities, that the water they need, particularly in the summertime, is actually a really stressed and scarce resource. And so a strategy that makes our energy and our water choices sustainable is really what we're talking about all the time in California. And so there are ways to, for example, cool power plants with air. We see that right now, some of the new solar farms that are coming online. And that's a technological innovation to reduce the water use almost to zero. But that story needs to be scaled up greatly. Water constraints are already a big deal in China in power plants, in particular in the summer. And it's actually an interesting point that the development of solar in some parts of China is being pushed ahead because of the need to keep water for agriculture and other purposes. So things are absolutely linked.
Hmm. Well, and then 250 municipalities have banned fracking. And I'm sure water is a major reason, because according to a lot of these documentaries, and we've done so many shows on this, but water is being contaminated also. So people have to bring in fresh water to drink because they can't drink the groundwater.
That's right. I think the caller raised another important issue, which is that as climate change takes place, the way in which the Earth kind of absorbs water and stores water in the form of snow is really changing. So that's just another part of the equation to keep in mind.
And so is the issue of water a concern when you talk to people who work in the energy sector? Does this come up?
Oh, it's a daily discussion. In fact, I was just at a meeting yesterday with the governor's team on both how California is going to manage fracking and on what are the water constraints on the high renewable energy future we're talking about. So one of the benefits that we do not monetize today, for example, in this transition to a great deal of renewables, is that we can find ways to beat that amount of water use way down. And so the current picture of meeting California's clean energy targets, which is a third of our electricity in 2020 from solar, wind, biomass, geothermal, is actually having solar make up a much larger share of that than we thought just a few years ago, because the path we're on right now, if it continues, which is a big if, is that solar will be directly cost competitive with other sources by the end of this decade. And that really would help to change the equation. But we need to do this across not only California, but in the states that we buy and sell energy from. And obviously, places like China and India are the fastest growing big demands for energy, and they're going to need to see this happen as well. So this interplay around and integrated not just energy and water, but other environmental impacts we want to deal with, air quality, biodiversity, that's really the holy grail of this process, making that overall transition work.
And we have an email from Sheila who says, I hear so little spoken about the health costs of fracking and the abundant use of precious water resources required for this. After watching Gasland, I was horrified at what people's lives have become in high fracking areas. And this morning's Al Jazeera America Online featured an article coming out of a medical research facility by endocrinologists warning us about the effects of fracking. Instead of paying attention to the truth of climate change, our government and media jump for joy over this awful means of giving us more gas for our bucks. Capitalism wins again. Well, thanks for the email, Sheila. And you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we've got full lines. We'll have one open in a few minutes. Let's hear from Billy. Is Billy gone? Is that Billy that was gone? Okay, let's try to go to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Good morning. I had a couple of questions. One was going to be commenting on what you've already brought up. But the bigger issue I want to raise with the guests is the impact of big agriculture in California, and largely with that being driven by meat eating, how much that's contributing to methane and the CO2 in the atmosphere. And largely that coinciding with that is the comments that have been made by the one person who said, you know, you don't tell someone who's starving and has the option of eating a cheeseburger, you know, not to eat it because of whatever ulterior things are, either about the environment or vegetarian. And also, when you were commenting on water, I think that also piggybacks on this, because the amount of water that's used in agriculture to grow grains to feed livestock is huge.
Right.
I don't know how it compares to the amount of water being used for fracking.
It's very large.
But And then lastly, I will just say I heard a show on the radio the other day that just said that people like me are perhaps being naive in thinking that we can get rid of factory farms and reproduce everything with, you know, grass-fed animals, et cetera, and so forth, considering the numbers of people in the United States that eat meat, that you could not fulfill that quantity to the extent that the way we, not we, you and me, but the United States is doing it now with agriculture and factory farms, this guest said that it was the least harmful to the environment. Hmm. And I was surprised, because I take the pie in the sky view that not eating meat is probably one of the best things I'm doing for the environment.
Yeah, well, it's interesting too, Ruthann, because it's not just the U.S. I mean, meat consumption is increasing around the globe, especially in the countries we've mentioned already, China, India, Brazil. According to the U.N., meat and dairy products account for 70% of global freshwater consumption, 38% of the total land use, and 19% of greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, the UN even said a vegan diet is vital to save the world from this issue, which a lot of us vegans, I'll put that out there, we're shocked because this is a massive body that says to stop eating meat and dairy. Now, this doesn't come up much when you talk about this issue, Catherine. Is this, do you all talk about this behind the scenes?
Yeah, definitely. We talk about this. And I think it just points to how many fundamental aspects of our day-to-day life are really contributing to climate change, what we eat, how we get to work. And that is why I think it's going to be hard, that it's just hard to change these kind of ingrained habits and fundamental aspects of the way we live our lives. It will require big changes.
Daniel?
Well, I think there's a couple parts of the story. One is we need to understand the impacts of all these different choices. There's been some very careful work done. Berkeley has a new food policy institute where the kind of the blanket condemnation of beef, for example, that I certainly was prepared to make some years ago, really is not the case. And there are free-range animals of various types that are, in fact, quite sustainable, and there's others that are not. And so the Ruthann's comments about factory-raised animals in agriculture, I think, is really the key part of the story. One of the tools that we were asked to build to address this is an online calculator called coolcalifornia.org. And that's a place where anyone can go online and do an energy and water and food inventory of their own lifestyles. And in fact, a number of cities have been using this calculator to do various competitions to see what's the most sustainable city in terms of energy, water, and food comes up all the time. So it's a key part of that overall story. I think that the real issue here is that we need to broaden out our economics, if you will. It's not just dollars and cents. It's dollars, cents, carbon, water. And tools like this coolcalifornia.org site are one of the ways to make those decisions clearer. And that's really where the debates in California and other parts of the world like Australia, where they're looking at what's the best sustainable land use practice. Carbon is part of that, but it's not the only story. And where are we putting our investments? And that's why the efforts to get companies to do energy audits, to look at are we financing additional fossil fuels as opposed to investing in renewables, where those campaigns really have an opportunity to both educate and allow us to change behavior.
So I would just add to that I think it's important for Californians and Americans to think about what's going on in their lives, that the real drivers of greenhouse gas emissions are the Chinese and people in India. So I think it's important to realize that people do respond to basic economic incentives. And if coal power is cheaper than solar power, that people crave power, as I've said, and will build coal plants until solar is radically cheaper.
Well, what do you mean by that? Because don't we have the largest carbon footprint, not in California, but in the United States?
So I think, you know, there's some, if you look at it at a country level, there's some countries like Bahrain that have larger. But yeah, we have very high carbon footprint. And as I've said, people in the developing world aspire to our level, our lifestyles.
So, I mean, I guess I would add to that on the point of Catherine's point on the cheeseburger is really quite key in the sense of there it is in front of you. But China, as many of us have been talking about recently, is experiencing today huge air quality, water quality, agricultural losses because of their fossil fuel diet. And the very, very polluting episodes of smog we've seen in Beijing and elsewhere are directly a result of cars and power plants. And so while China has not turned that equation, if you will, right now, they're ahead of us in some respects. They're a much bigger producer of solar panels, wind turbines, electric vehicles. China as a nation has a carbon price in place. It's lower than I would like. It's about half of that in California, but the U.S. government does not. And so while that cheeseburger may be sitting in front of you, maybe you eat the first one, and then you realize that eating more of them is bad for you. And China is, in fact, in many ways, a bigger leader in clean tech than we are. They just also happen to be a bigger polluter than we are at the same time. But you know, it's neck and neck in terms of who is the dirtier agent at this point.
Maybe you can use a veggie burger in your next comment when you talk about how to compare this. That's Daniel Kam, and has parallel professorships in the Energy and Resources Group, the Department of Nuclear Engineering, and the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. Catherine Wolfram is the Cora Jane Flood Professor of Business Administration and Director of the Energy Institute at the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the future of energy. And we're also talking about this interesting report that's getting a lot of attention. It came out from the U.S. Energy Department this week, predicting a massive increase in domestic oil production over the next 2 years, 800,000 barrels of oil a day. Natural gas will soon replace coal as the largest source of electricity by 2035. The fracking boom is expected to continue. We've got full lines, so why don't we take a few calls in a row and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Okay, are we having phone line problems? Robert, are you there? Let's go to Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex.
Yeah, hi. When we talk about energy, we always say because gas prices is so low, alternative energy development is discouraged. Well, I beg to differ. A lot of people work in minimum wage and close to that. That price is very, very expensive, very, very high. Mm. So the emphasis should be on development of attractive mass transit. Mass transit right now is not attractive. It's very, very repulsive. A lot of violence goes on in these buses. They are not clean. So they push people away instead of attracting them. So unless you have alternative, there is no way of transporting yourself to work. And then if you got to pay $10 for gas, I mean, what do you want to eat?
Yeah.
Now, rich people can drive cars, pay any price they want. Won't be true for the 99%.
Thank you, Alex.
So just a quick clarification,
okay.
There's natural gas and gasoline, and they both are shorthand to gas. And so when I said natural gas prices are low, when I said gas prices are low, I meant natural gas prices.
At $2.
Yeah.
And this report says gas will be around $3 a gallon by 2016.
Right. Now, I mean, but one thing to think about here is, I mean, the caller is right that there's a lot of financial issues around energy that affect the poor much more than the affluent. And part of that story is that while low gas prices, and I mean natural gas prices, look like they're going to be this panacea in some people's eyes, on the other hand, while electric vehicles a few years ago were much more expensive than conventional cars, you can now find electric vehicles that are basically on par with the price of a regular vehicle and per mile driven. It can be as a third the cost or less to drive that electric vehicle. Now, putting everyone in an electric vehicle is not the solution to our mass transport problems, but the ability to think about alternatives to gas that are good for the environment and save people money is the equation that we're talking about more broadly here. So California's climate plan pays equal attention to cleaner electricity and cleaner transportation. Now, we don't have all the solutions yet, but it's an example of, I think, just what the caller was talking about.
Well, why don't we try in our remaining 7 minutes to really talk about solutions? And our next caller wants to talk about the shift that we really need politically and culturally. Let's hear from Ophir in Berkeley. Hi, Ophir. Welcome to the show.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for having me on the call. So just real quick, and I'm going to keep it a little vague to let the speakers, voice their opinions, but I think what we really need is a paradigm shift, and one that's rooted in our culture and our politics and sort of the fundamental ways we think about the way we use resources and the way we use energy. And I feel like a lot of the work that's being done addresses more of the symptoms of these issues and doesn't sort of go at the root of the way our politics is set up. And so my question is around the role of sort of grassroots campaigns and campaigns out there that help shift our culture as public and our politics. We see the fossil fuel industry holds, you know, an immense amount of power over our political system and the kind of roadblocks that poses to instituting the kind of change we need, but also the way people, the public, think about the way we use resources and how grassroots campaigns can play a fundamental part in the kind of shifts we need to see culturally and politically.
Well, it's a great question. And to add to it, Charles in Fort Bragg says, as a reformed carbon polluter, I find the news of abundant new supplies of fossil fuels discouraging. One hope is that natural gas abundance might help bury coal for good. Where I live, the land of one pickup truck per adult male, very few people care enough to make any personal changes. It's very discouraging. I do feel that unconsciousness is the root cause of all of these problems. So how can we raise consciousness? Catherine, before the show, we were talking about CO2 being sort of an odorless. It's odorless. You can't really see it. So how do you shift consciousness? Because I'm just in the last 50 minutes, we've been talking about so many different elements of this one issue.
Yeah, it's hard from kind of a basic marketing perspective. As you said, CO2 is odorless. It's invisible. The damage is years in the future. So it's just hard to get people to focus on it. Whereas the earlier caller pointed out, people think day to day about the price of gasoline because they're buying it on a daily basis. And so, you know, making those trade-offs, it tends towards the things that affect us immediately and not towards the things that will affect us in the future and that we can't see, we can't smell, we can't touch.
Daniel, what do you find really works?
Well, I mean, I think a fear is onto the right issue. I mean, 2 weeks ago in the student newspaper here on campus, the Daily Californian, I wrote an op-ed saying that we needed to divest from fossil fuels. And both UC Berkeley and the UC system have committed to removing fossil fuels from our energy mix over the coming just a little over a decade. And I think that's an excellent start. And in California, with a green energy mix, we can do that. The second part of the equation, though, is that we really need to send strong signals that we are not against big energy companies, but we need their portfolios to switch. And so the idea to divest from fossil fuels is something that we're talking about here in the UC system. Cornell's faculty just voted to divest. Harvard, for example, voted not to divest. A number of schools are having different debates and positions on this, but it is the key signal. And as we kind of think about the lessons from Nelson Mandela, who came to the Bay Area and implored California companies and universities to keep sanctions on South Africa, even though they were hurting the black African population in the short term, it was part of the strategy to push the government to change. And that's the discussion that we're now having. And it's a place where individuals can get directly involved. A clean energy mix is the start of the story, but transitioning our financial mechanisms is the second part. And that's why I wrote the op-ed.
And what do you both think about focusing on individual action, which has gotten so much attention over the last couple of years, especially starting with Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, versus really targeting these corporations? There's a new report out called A Toxic 100, naming the top corporate air polluters. And at the top is Precision Castaparts. I've never even heard of this company. And then DuPont, Bayer, Dow, and Exxon, the top five corporate air polluters in the United States, according to the University of Massachusetts Amherst. So where do you both fall on this? Because there's so much focus on us, right? What we should do to deal with this. But what about corporations and the government's role here? Catherine?
Yeah, that's important. I mean, any individual person is just a tiny drop in the bucket. But I think as Ophir, the previous caller, pointed out, what we can do is try to inspire our global leaders to take on climate change, that this is a global problem and it requires kind of massive action. It requires, I would advocate, investment in basic research.
And so if you had Obama's ear, what two policy changes would you like to see?
So I would love to see a carbon tax. I think that the way to achieve goals is to incentivize things that help meet those goals. And I would encourage him to be a little bit humble about thinking, about picking a specific technology that will achieve that goal. I think something like a carbon goal or a carbon tax is technology agnostic, basically, and says, we don't know. We need to encourage, inspire basic innovation that will help us achieve that goal, but we don't know how to get there. I think the last point I would make is that it's important to take risks. It's important to be willing to fail in any innovative process.
And Daniel, what changes would you like to see?
Well, there's no question that a carbon price is one of them. It's a bit like asking industry to change their patterns without giving any signal. And so that's got to be one of the pieces. And we see that in California. And so we know we can do it. It's gone on elsewhere. So carbon price is one of them. But the other one is this political action point. And we have seen, for example, in the work that my lab does that says that the western part of the United States could really drive the carbon out of its system with what looks like a pretty modest price difference over the next couple decades. That says it's possible. But the way to get there is to invest in basic research, but much more critically at this point, to make the financial commitment. And that's a place where individuals, by talking to their politically elected officials about what are the opportunities, what are their stance on things like divesting from fossil fuels, investing in mass transit to meet people's needs and make quality of life better, those are all available to us now. And politicians directly listen to when their constituents ask what is their position on these key issues. And that's the other piece. It's that political engagement as well as that financial tool that we really need.
Daniel Kamen is an energy and nuclear engineer at UC Berkeley. Catherine Wolfram is an economist. And Cora Jane Flood, professor of business at UC Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you. And I'm really sorry we didn't get to all your phone calls, but we will definitely continue to follow this important issue. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What is the value of biosynthetics? On the next Your Call, we'll have a debate about the emerging field of synthetic biology. Biologists are now synthesizing everything from petroleum to vanilla, and the Bay Area is ground zero for this research. What are the implications of this kind of technology? Proponents say it will save natural resources and curb global warming. Opponents say it's an extreme version of genetic engineering and poses too many environmental and health risks. Where do you stand? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.